Okay, so Immunex people.
Well, I suggested Stuart Parker. She was the first person we hired before we had a door or anything to open. And she worked through a series of positions. Initially, I hired her and said, you know, you have to do everything from keep the books to handle any correspondence we need, anything of that kind at all. She had just gotten her MBA at the UW. But there's no work that'll be beneath you until we get enough going here that we need a staff, and then you can begin to do some more serious kind of business work. Mm-hmm. She accepted it on those conditions, and ultimately, when we spun out Targeted Genetics, we spun her out as the CEO of Targeted Genetics. But she was through the whole thing, and she provided interesting woman's perspective on all that went on. She was a vice president of Immunex and held a number of positions. Ran corporate communications. She was a very, very talented lady.
Okay, good. Where is she at now?
She's in Seattle. H. Stuart Parker.
All right, I'll look her up.
Yeah.
Good. Others? What about some of the other scientists maybe working under
that worked
Gillis.
Under Steve Gillis? I'm sure Steve would have some ideas on this too, but I think that David Urdahl, U-R-D-A-L, who may still be active. He was doing something at Dendron as recently as a couple of years ago, and I just haven't heard any more since then. But he was very active, and he was a protein chemist and very active in some of that early cloning of the interleukins and stuff that we did. He would have some interesting scientific perspectives, I suppose.
Good. I find it usually once we get about six or seven people from one place, then we start to get, you know, we get multiple perspectives on everything. We start to get a good sense of what was.
Another woman is Susan Erb, who came to work for us in the science operations and was one of the very first employees in that. And then while working, got her MBA also. And she moved on into operations, but she built our first plants. She built all of our laboratory facilities. Everything that had to do with a facility was under her. She put in generation after generation of scientific equipment. Mm-hmm. So she has a kind of an interesting view on the nuts and bolts of the building of a biotech company.
Yeah.
As we integrated functions, starting with obviously science, but then moving on to manufacturing, and then the marketing people came in and she had to provide for them.
Okay, that's good. Well, listen, what I'd like to do with this is put together a biography, basically. I mean, we're interested, especially with the biotech stuff, but why don't we start with your background. Tell me about yourself. Where do you come from? Where were you born?
I was born in Oregon in 1941, just before World War II began. I have very little recollection of World War II, but I moved to Seattle when I was 10 with my family, and lived there through high school, went off to Dartmouth for a while, transferred back to the University of Washington.
Tell me a little bit about your family. What's the background there?
I have two siblings, both of whom are still living, both of whom are younger than I am. And I have my father died during World War II.
Oh.
He was not killed in combat, but he died of kidney disease that he contracted when he was in training. My mother was a single mother long before single mothers were any kind of vogue. And she was quite a lady. She she was educated before she had any kids, and which was not all that common, incidentally, at that time.
Right, yeah.
And she took us to Seattle so she could pursue her interests, which were merchandising and fashion. And she went to work for what's called the Bon Marché up there, now part of Macy's, and rose through the ranks there. She was the assistant to the CEO of Bon Marché for 20 years.
So even though you had a single mother, she was doing pretty well.
She had a wonderful career of her own. Long after the kids were out of the nest, she continued that. And she's dead now. She would be 93 if she was still living. And I'm from a cattle ranching family who went to Central Oregon as pioneers in the 1860s and
70s. Just the Bend area? Or
Yes. East of Bend, there's a small town called Prineville. Prineville is the oldest town east of the Cascades in the Oregon Territory. Older than Walla Walla, which was a very early missionary settlement. It was the where there was a blacksmith shop and a place for provisioning for the Oregon Trail on the final push to the Dalles, Oregon, where most of them went. And my family stopped there because they were cattle people, and there's good cattle raising, grazing in that area.
Was there any of that left when you came along?
Yeah, I actually was, my early first 10 years were spent on that ranch.
Oh, yeah.
And so I started riding a horse when I was 4, and I was driving a tractor by the time I was 10. I went back every summer until I was 17 from Seattle and spent the summers there at the ranch. So I was a ranching kid and spent almost all of my time plotting how I would never have to be a rancher.
Really?
I was not interested. My brother was, but I wasn't the slightest bit interested. I wanted to head. Life magazine had convinced me there was more to life than you could find.
Well, what did you have in mind? What did you want to do?
Well, I wanted to be a lawyer. And I actually studied in undergraduate school. I studied political science and history with the intention of going on to. And that was recommended by lawyers, I think.
And that's at Dartmouth?
I started at Dartmouth and then finished at the University of Washington. And then
going all the way across the country to Dartmouth.
And that was a mistake, really, for me, as I look back on it. I was not a very happy camper at Dartmouth. I didn't know a soul. I had no connection, whatever, with anyone back there. They came and got me. They were pushing for to have a national student body. And so they came to the West Coast looking for kids. And I can't remember how it was that we came.
Were you a good student?
Yeah,
does he help the plates that come out?
Sure.
Thank you. Oh,
it's good for me.
That's great. Very nice.
Thank you. Anything else?
That was getting me started. Thank you.
Thanks. That's a lot of fish.
So I got a scholarship to go there, and I thought it was an interesting idea, so off I went. But in retrospect, I was a Western kid. It was an all-boys school, and as I said, I didn't know anyone. You were pretty isolated up there in those days. There were no freeways.
Still.
Well, it is now, but my God, now there are regular flights out of Burlington, Vermont, to cities all over the place, and freeways that connect it, and trains that run fast. It was used to be a 8-hour train ride to New York City and 4 hours to Boston. So if you didn't know people and didn't have a way to get away for a holiday or something, you never got out of there, and I didn't care for it. So I switched back to the UW, which I did like tremendously, and had a lot of friends there. So I pursued studies to try to become a lawyer there, and then went to law school, entered in 1963. And lasted about a year before it was clear to me that that wasn't what I was cut out to do. I was not the detailed guy that I needed to be a lawyer. So in those days, you either went to go get an MBA or you went to work in a management training program, and I did the latter and went to work for a local manufacturing company in Seattle.
You like the city?
I loved Seattle. Seattle was not anything like it is today in the 1960s.
It's still not a huge place.
Well, it's a big city.
It's a big city,
and
yes.
It's very cosmopolitan now. Yeah. The food there is as good as any place in the United States. The art and the culture are superb. There's every kind of thing that anyone could want there now. Mm-hmm. And wonderful suburbs as well as a great inner city. A downtown that's lively and goes all through the night. Really, Seattle is nothing like when I was a kid. It was a sleepy, backward, not very exciting place.
But was the Navy there? Was that?
The Navy is all around there, but not specifically in Seattle. No, Boeing was the big employer. One of the great days of my life, as an aside, was when the market cap of Immunex was larger than the market cap of Boeing at one point.
Wow.
Having grown up in Seattle, that was a red letter day for a Seattle kid that company.
I would have never guessed that.
Well, yeah. Boeing got in some trouble, and they shrunk, and Immunex got overcapitalized, probably for its status, but there was about a 2-week period in there where our market cap was actually greater than that.
So you found your niche managing?
Mm-hmm. I did. I really liked business, and I liked the strategic side of business. I went to work for a company that was just getting started with some very early work in air pollution control, and so I wound up in that department, and at quite a young age, actually, because it was growing fairly rapidly, became the assistant manager of that division, and then finally the manager of it, and I was not yet 35.
So this is kind of a technology.
Mm-hmm. It was.
What did they have? What was?
Well, they did two or three things. They had a line of, that they had created of what were called scrubbers that scrub fumes from smoke, and they were designed in those early stages for incineration. Both municipal and large building or manufacturing plant incinerators. Incinerators were spewing out a lot of smog in those days. And
so a scrubber, is it kind of something like a filter? Or?
Well, it is. It gives the air a bath on the way up to the stack. Mm-hmm. It washes the particulate out of the air and then releases the air to the environment. Mm-hmm. It would be today not considered a particularly strong technology, but in the 1960s it was one of the better ways to get either industrial pollutants or the particulate matter that results from burning garbage to get that out of the air.
So where did you put these things?
Oh, all over the country.
Yeah.
We had them in everywhere from New York City to Georgia and quite a lot around Philadelphia, interestingly. There was we had used manufacturers reps. Wherever we had a good salesman, we had good business. But then we started becoming the construction arm for a number of European companies who made electrostatic precipitators, which are still in big use today. And all over the western United States, we began to install electrostatic precipitators on coal-fired power plants. And that became a really big line of business. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting stuff. In 1974, a group of local investor people came to me and said that they were about to buy a totally different business in Seattle, but they'd had their eye on me, they said, and wondered if I would be interested in going in as the CEO of that.
How old were you at this time?
34.
Still a young guy.
Yeah, pretty young for the job I got. I thought I was ready for it. I probably wasn't, but I learned pretty fast. Mm-hmm. And this was a completely different kind of company. It was chemically based, and it made packaging, all kinds of plastic and resin-based packaging. Mm-hmm. Everything from bread bags and things that food are done into industrial wrappers for industrial products. So I ran that for 5 years, and we sold it to ARCO in 1980.
How was it that these companies, both of them, how did they end up in, or how did they come to be in Seattle?
They were founded by Seattle people.
No.
Cello was started by three guys who were GIs who came out of World War II and got some funding and began the company. They'd been plotting it while they were in the service in the South Pacific. The manufacturing company that was involved in air pollution control was started by a Seattle guy who was quite a bit older. I mean, he would not have fought in World War II. He was older than that. He was in the 60s when I became involved in already. And it was actually being run by a younger engineering guy who had come up through the ranks with the founder, and the founder had turned the running of the business over to him by the time I was involved.
Mm-hmm. well, through this succession of positions here, what's the substance of the work you're doing, and what kind of lessons are you learning along the way?
Well, I mean, I learned how to run a company, how to organize it, how to contain costs, how to position it for success, I think. I understood that, and I still understand that. I was unusual among the guys who got it started in biotech, because I didn't come out of the pharmaceutical or the academic areas, and I had not been involved in biologic research in any way, shape, or form. I'd taken some science classes at the UW, but nobody was talking about cloning anything when I was going to school. So I came in with a guy as a kind of a seat of the pants guy who ran businesses, and we were Chris Henney and Steve Gillison. These are good. Very good.
Thank you.
We were introduced in 1980, and it was sort of serendipitous. When I was in the process of selling off the packaging company to Atlantic Richfield, one of the lawyers who was working on that, he was representing some of the investors in our business, asked me what I knew him, and he asked me what I was going to do when I got finished with this. I had 6 months to serve under ARCO, but then I was free to go. Probably would have been encouraged to go if I hadn't, but I was happy to do it.
So both of these prior companies are very successful. Are you growing them up? And
they both they were very successful. The manufacturing company that I started with was ultimately liquidated. I was on its board for years and years after I left work. And it was ultimately liquidated because of its real estate became more valuable than the activities that were taking place on it.
Where was it located?
Well, it was located right on Harbor Island in the middle of the port of Seattle. And the port needed it. And so, and they were willing to pay top dollar to consolidate what they were doing. So it was sold. They had other operations down in the south at Fort Smith, Arkansas. And those were in what was becoming the Fort Smith, Arkansas Industrial Park development or something, and they wanted those. So, the families that owned it, and I had only a very minor interest, the ones who really had some interest in it, decided they would sell it. It became basically a real estate deal.
Yeah. How did you feel about that?
It was the best thing to do. They had not planned well for succession. The engineer who ran it when I was there was still running it by the time it was liquidated. He was way past the time when he should have been running anything. And so it was the best thing to do. They got their fortunes out, and everybody left happy. I think otherwise it was going to come to the point where the heirs of these people were going to have an enormous fight over who was going to run and control this thing. Because nobody was really in a position to control it without somebody else being involved.
Right.
Once it got split up, and not one child of those two men was involved in business, had a clue how to run. So it really was the best thing.
That was your recommendation at the time?
I was on the board.
Yeah.
And actually, one other director and I were the ones who sort of created their scenario for liquidation. Mm-hmm. All of the plants went to China. They're, I presume, still operating. They were all torn apart.
What was the date?
Well, it was, let's see, I haven't thought about that for a long time. It was sometime in the mid-90s that the final things were shut down. Maybe it began around 1990, 91.
Yeah. No, China hadn't really taken off by that point.
Well, but there was these plants could be used for fundamental steel fabrication, and that's what they were sent there to do. And the same equipment is used to make I-beams for skyscrapers that's used to make a pollution control plant. So that equipment went over there for that purpose. And one of the engineering guys that I knew quite well went with it for a period of time. And he came back raving about what was going on in China. Growth that was already occurring.
Mm-hmm. So the other deals, are you involved in negotiating these sales?
Well, I didn't have anything to do with the direct negotiation of the sale of the manufacturing company, Leckenby Company, but I was on the board and was involved in setting up the strategy by which it was sold. I directly negotiated the sale of the packaging company with Argo. I mean, I ran that negotiation. And then, as I started to say, talking to one of these lawyers that was involved in that deal, as we were wrapping it up, he said, "What are you going to do?"
And so I said, Seattle lawyer?
Yes, although the firm he was with operated more broadly than that. Anyway, I said to him, "I don't know." I said, "I either find another business to buy, because I think the guys that bought this one would buy another one, or possibly buy, or possibly start a company. I've always been interested in starting a company." We didn't say another word. I actually finished up my Arco stuff and went off and spent 6 or 7 months helping a friend of mine straighten out the operations of his business. I'm always listed in things like prospectuses for Immunex as having worked for an ice machinery company, but I really was only
helping you
staying there. There was no intention that I would be there for a long time, but you know, you have to have the cold hard facts in the prospectus, so that's where I'm always listed as having been in the ice machine business before Immunex.
Uh-huh.
I always thought that was sort of funny. A lot of people were taken aback a little about that. I think they envisioned ice cube dispensing machines or something. These were actually industrial machines that make ice that's put into concrete in hot climates when they're making concrete. It's fairly sophisticated. If you go to Saudi Arabia, as these guys did with their machines, they build giant runways or street roads and so on in horrendous temperatures. They do it around here. They mix ice in the concrete so that it will cure more slowly. Hmm. Because in hot temperatures, the evaporation occurs so rapidly that the concrete is...
It makes a crushed ice? Or?
These things made a sheet of ice. It was not actually crushed. It was a thin sheet of ice, maybe yay thick. There was a kind of a constant scraper inside a cylinder that would scrape that off. So it would be like that thick. It looked like broken window pane, shards of glass.
Uh-huh,
this was shards of ice.
Yeah.
And that's what those kinds of chips went in. And they would provide a uniform curing in hot temperatures.
Boy, I wonder who invented that. That's a good idea.
The guy that my friend bought the company from invented that. It was a nifty little business, but he didn't know how to run anything, so we spent some time getting his costs under control. In any event, bringing the lawyer back in the meantime, he had run into a patent lawyer in Seattle, and the patent lawyer said, "You know, I've been approached by two guys from the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center who have invented some cancer cures." I remember the word cure being involved.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure never, ever did that come out of the lips of Gillis or Henney, but it certainly had become the way that these lay people were translating it. And he said, "We're trying to figure out how they could turn it into a business because they think biotech's interesting." Quite by coincidence, I'd been reading a lot of stuff about the creation of Genentech.
You have?
Yeah, I was very interested in it. Genentech was then 2 or 3 years old.
Yeah.
So I got a call from my lawyer friend who said, "I've met this guy. Would you meet with these two scientists and just talk to them?" And I thought that would be interesting. If nothing else, just to hear what they were doing scientifically. Mm-hmm. So we met. We had actually a series of meetings in late 80 and early 81. And out of that, we agreed to start the company.
What were your impressions of these guys and the science and their ideas about turning into business?
In terms of business, or the starting of a business, or anything having to do with a corporate activity, they were totally naive. They were academic guys. Henney was from England, had been an academic all his life, had, I don't think, spent 5 minutes inside an American company. Steve Gillis was still very young, basically a postdoc, and had gotten his PhD only shortly before that, still in his late 20s, but absolutely brilliant. I mean, you knew the minute Gillis opened his mouth and began to talk that he had a gift, and I later came to understand how important that gift is. he could actually take this stuff they were working on and translate it into English for people in a very understandable way. You could see right away that the guy just had a tremendous ability to communicate. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but he had some... when I talked about creating businesses and why I thought most... they were a little apprehensive about a business in one sense because they heard most businesses fail. And I said, well, most businesses fail because they're not well run. There aren't systems in place that assure that the plan gets executed and that the money lasts, the capital that you raise lasts. So among the long discussions we had, I had some with them where I tried to tell them that it wouldn't work like the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. Maybe while you're sitting at the bench doing the actual nuts and bolts of the science, it won't seem any different to you or anybody else, but the environment in which you work will have to be different. It can't be... we can't have 30 PhD scientists running all over the place doing whatever they want to do. They've got to be focused into an activity. I think, in a sense, it was very good that I was naive about their world and they were naive about mine. Because I proposed things that later most other biotech firms said, my God, how did you ever manage to pull that off? Well, I pulled it off because I didn't know any better. And I had in Gillis a guy who could sort of see why I was doing what I was doing. I'll give you an example. When we first began Immunex, I proposed that our scientific staff keep track of their work and report it to us, much as a lawyer would report his hours to a billing department in the law firm. That we had each project had a project number, and these guys were to work on it. And they would keep track of which project they worked on and how much involvement they had day by day. Mm-hmm. And our guys bought it because it would enable us to know where we were expending our resources, how they were getting used, and we could measure that against our success. I don't know of another scientific organization that I've ever heard of where scientists were responsible for keeping track of where they spent the money
right
at the time. And where every scientific project from the beginning had a budget and was tracked monthly against budget to make sure that we were devoting the resources. We were perfectly free mid-year at any time to change the budget. I said we'll do that, but we'll potentially borrow the funds for that change from some other place because the funds are not infinite. We've got to keep them under control.
So let's go back to the beginning of this when you're first talking about having discussions about,
Well, I discussed a lot of the time I spent discussing how I thought any business that was going to succeed had to have controls. And that's really why I'm giving you that last bit as an illustration. Mm-hmm. They were extremely concerned that they would be left free to do their science. They were concerned that investment people and people like me would start telling them how to do their science. And I told them that I didn't have any plans to come in and tell them how to do their science, only to tell them to work out with them the environment in which they would do their science so that we had a chance for some success. Mm-hmm. And that they couldn't just put down what they were working on today and go rushing off over here. And they bought all of that. They could see that if we could raise $1 million, to pick a number, that was only going to last a certain number of months, and that they would have to spend it well enough so that I could raise the second $1 million, and so on. We had a lot of discussions about that. From the beginning, it was clear to me that the guy who could make this work was Gillis. And the guy who was going to strain and suffer under it was Henny. Henny had been he was my age. We were born exactly the same year. Mm-hmm. He'd been in academia for a long time and was not used to the kind of thing I was talking about. While I think he always saw the wisdom of it and always wanted it to happen that way, it was very difficult for him personally to stay within the confines of a corporate operation. Mm-hmm. So, as you know, Chris has moved around a bit in the business. He was with us for a while, then he moved on and started Corixa with George Rathman. Right. And then ultimately went off and got involved in what became
Dendrion. What, advanced cell therapy or something like that, initially? Well, did you have a notion? This business is unlike, it must have been unlike any other that you...
Right. It was. But it was still... I mean, I was much more alarmed at when I analyzed what Genentech was trying to do, to read things like there hadn't been a fully integrated pharmaceutical company created in the United States since World War II, and yet our business plan was going to be to create a fully integrated pharmaceutical company, and I already knew of a number of other companies that either were up and running or going to be that had this in mind, and it seemed rather incredible that 25 new pharmaceutical companies were going to spring into existence. So,
is there a plan on paper that does one still exist?
Well, if it does, I don't have it. Yeah. A lot of this stuff, a huge amount of this stuff, was sent to the Museum of History and Industry in Seattle. Yeah. I still have the bound books from every offering we did. I have every prospectus. They're bound into volumes every time we did any kind of a financing. So I've got 16 volumes, maybe, of stuff from that. I have all the annual reports. I've got a lot of that stuff. But the planning side of it, when I left there, I didn't take it with me. What I took with me in the things I've just described were my copies of those things. Mm-hmm. And I took them along because I thought it'd be interesting someday to sit down and read them, although I've never done it. Mm-hmm. But it's possible that those plans would still exist. The initial business plan I wrote and took to Tom Cable of Cable and House in early 81, and he made some suggestions for some changes in it, but not in the basic strategy. And we had as our goal and that we were going to create and discover drugs, and that ultimately we were going to manufacture them, market them. As the years unfolded, I have to say, I became skeptical that anybody was going to do this.
Only a handful did.
Well, I think, when we did it, I believe we were the third. Amgen and Genentech had done it before us.
Yeah.
And a handful come along after that, three or four maybe, that made it out in any kind of time. Henry Tremere's organization and Biogen. Mm-hmm. And then it gets sort of fuzzy after that because a lot of the marketing is done by other people or in partnership with other people or in joint ventures with other people.
Right. Well, there were a couple of other Seattle companies, too. Did you keep track of them at all?
Mm-hmm.
Zymogenetics, Genetic Systems.
Zymogenetics, I was privy to their existence before they existed. Because Tom Cable was also trying to become the venture capital guru behind that one.
Is he still around?
Yeah, Tom is up in San Juan Island. He spends the year up there. He just finished spearheading the project of building our first hospital on that little island.
Huh.
And it just opened in October.
Yeah, are the winters mild because of the...
Yeah, they have some cold weather. Tom, however, is not... He tried to come down to Arizona and spend time, but he's not a golfer.
Uh-huh.
And he's not, you know, if he was going to hike, he'd rather have rain falling on him than sunshine. Because he doesn't like heat. So he and Barbara are happy up there. They're snug. And they're a couple of bugs in a rug, I think. And they like that environment. I would not want to spend the whole year up there.
So he was involved with Immunex and also...
Zymome.
And I should probably talk to him.
Well, you could, sure. And I could help you do that. I'll give you the information as we leave here. Tom is a very smart guy. He wanted us to consider potentially putting those two things together, Zymome and Immunex. And I know that Henny in particular, but Gillis too, weren't at all keen on that. They thought that that was just so totally foreign to what... they saw it basically as an expression company. They, at that point, the big deal was that they could express proteins in yeast as opposed to E. coli. And so they were...
Did you have a yeast geneticist then?
Well, we did. We didn't when we began, but we did as soon as we got to the point where that was a useful thing. We did do several molecules in yeast. We did something in, did some in mammalian cells. We actually had pretty good expression capability. I will also tell you that there was an attempt made just about that time for Immunex and Amgen to be combined into a single company.
Oh, way, way
before there was a company. I met with, neither one was a company yet.
Huh.
I met with George Rathman. I can't remember now where how that got started, but that was another one where we were potentially going to have a an amalgamation of something before we began.
You know, I heard he tried to he went to San Francisco and talked to Bill Rutter too,
mm-hmm.
about trying to, you know, to start Amgen North.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe, well, I wonder if this is before or after that.
I don't know. I mean, it was interesting. We were...
Fish?
Yeah.
We were... I'm sorry, I'm doing the talking.
Yeah.
We were... two companies that ran in parallel for years, just as an aside. Our registration numbers for public offerings are one number apart. And I can't tell you now which had the lower of the two numbers, but we went public virtually the same day. We were on our road shows for public offerings at the IPOs at the exact same day. And, of course, we were bitter rivals in the CSF world. So those two companies, it's interesting they finally did come together because there were certainly plenty of way of times along the way when they were very closely wrapped up with each other. So, and I knew George well. I thought George was a great guy.
Did you meet him from that meeting?
Well, that's when I first met him. I got to know him a lot better through our days in the IDA.
Yeah. But what was the conversation, the initial conversation about putting...
Well, you know, George had ideas for companies, but he didn't have science. Amgen was not, at its inception, a real strong scientific organization, and there are people who will say Amgen was never particularly a strong research organization. And I'm making no judgments, I don't know. But I've heard that by plenty of people. Mm-hmm. George was looking for things, and he was particularly interested in IL-2, things that he could promote as the projects of his company. And so I think that was his interest, to get his hands on the stuff that we were talking about as products for our company.
How did he know about, how early was this?
This was in 1981.
Okay, so you just gotten started. What was the date that you...
Well, we incorporated and started everything in July of that year, I think. But the conversations with George Rathman would have occurred before that.
Oh.
And George knew about it because IL-2 was already being talked about quite a bit,
and he
it was pretty clear that Gillis was the guy who knew what was happening with IL-2. We began with far less capital than any other company, as far as I know. I raised $1 million from an initial set of venture capitalists, and that was enough to build the initial facility that we occupied in an old marine hardware warehouse building on the waterfront in Seattle that had just been rehabbed by a property developer.
So you used the money to put labs in?
We put labs in very small offices. It was pretty Spartan. It covered about, I think, around 16,000 square feet was all we had. We hired about 30 people. And that was the initial startup crew that actually didn't get going till the spring of '82 because it took us that long to build out labs and get going.
So what was going? What were? Had you hired anybody in that interview?
Yeah, we did, and we hired some of the people were folks already working for Henny and Gillis at the Hutch. I went to the Hutch early and said, these guys want to come out of here. We need to make some arrangements if they're coming out, because you're entitled to something for what's gone on here. We believe that. But at the same time, we don't want some encumbrance down the road. So how are we going to do this? So we made a deal.
Well, were there discussions, was there any talk of them staying
at the hutch?
Yeah, and, you know, have the company, because, you know,
from the beginning, the venture capitalists and I both said, no, you're either full-time at the company or we're not doing this. And there's no split activities, no split loyalties. But the hutch did allow them to start the science operations of ImmuNet within the hutch for about 6 or 8 months while things got built.
And what persuaded them to do that?
Well, we gave them some stock in the company, and in return for their release of the intellectual property. And they were cooperative. I think they realized that this was going to go away, but from there, physically, but that they'd like to stay involved with it, and there was a chance for that. So,
yeah.
And that, as it worked out, leukine and bone marrow transplant, all of really worked. That was done in patients at the hutch. And of course, bone marrow transplant was essentially created at the hutch to begin with. So there were a lot of relationships that went on for a long time. I was on the board of the hutch for a number of years. One or two guys from the hutch were on our scientific advisory board for quite a number of years. So we've had relationships back and forth. But
so it was always good.
We got everybody extracted and the intellectual property extracted, and there was never any further complication or difficulty from that. And then I went to Nutley, New Jersey, and we put together the IL-2 deal with Roche. And I don't remember now how I'd come in contact with them, but I had found copies of two deals that had been done by other biotech firms, so I knew something of the terms that were being included in these deals.
Well, what deals were they?
Well, you know, I don't honestly remember. I wish I could tell you. And I don't know, of course, whatever happened to them either, because you never really worry about the stuff that you didn't need anymore. But I did have a chance to read two of those, and I think they almost surely must have come from a venture capitalist. I mean, all that kind of stuff came from them.
Mm-hmm. By the way, who are the venture capitalists that
came? Well, the ones who were backing us at that time were the Mayfield Fund, Cable & House, the venture capital arm of Diamond Shamrock.
Mayfield is Silicon Valley.
Yes, and I don't think that NEA was involved at the very outset. I think they came in the second round, but they may have been in the very first round.
So, and this is new for you, getting venture money?
Yes.
Like this?
I had not done this before. I didn't find that particularly difficult. I thought venture capitalists were easy guys to deal with. I didn't ever have any big problems with them.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say that we always had a problem. We were not in the Silicon Valley. We weren't.
Yeah.
We weren't part of the San Francisco circle.
Right.
And so we were always outsiders. That was just a fact of life. We kind of turned that to an internal advantage and used it as a way to spur people to work harder. That we were going to prove to everybody down south that we were as good or better than the other guys. But we were not thought of as the best guys in the business down in the Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And our science was always not as good as somebody else's in the beginning. But we did get investors from there. I'm trying to remember Jeff Pickard's firm. I don't remember the name of the firm. But you know Jeff Pickard, the name?
No,
of the firm?
It's
a good-sized firm, and I'm just remiss in not being able to think of it. Anyway, we had, I think, five or so of those guys.
And they went on the board?
Glenn, what was Glenn's last name? Mueller, who later committed suicide 5 or 6 years after this happened. Just a tragedy that touched everybody in Silicon Valley. Glenn was on the board. Tom Cable was on the board. And then Dick Kramlich came on the board fairly early in this game. And I think they were the only three that were on the board. I'd be fairly sure that that's right. There were six directors, and three of them were venture capitalists. And the company was fairly evenly split 50-50 at that point. The second round of funds that we raised produced another $2 or $3 million, allowed us to expand facilities. We were only private for another 8 months or so after that, and then we went public in 1983 and raised enough money to really get going. And by that time, we had the deal with Roche done. We had a deal with Hoechst and Bering Verka in Germany to do some work on CSFs. And we were beginning to put together some other deals besides. We may have had another one done, but I don't remember exact timing.
And going public, that was some. Had you taken a company public before?
That was there too.
Yeah.
Yeah. An interesting process. And one that I really enjoyed. For the first few years, I liked being a public company, even though the market for biotech stocks was just goofy. One company would do something wonderful,
right,
and boom, the stocks would soar. Another company would miss a deadline that some analyst that didn't know anything had said would be made, and every stock would plunge. And this went on for years.
Yeah.
So once you got used to that roller coaster, I thought being a publicly traded company was kind of cool. It creates a lot of attention for what you're doing. And then IL-2 was a big story nationally.
Yeah.
Cover story for Fortune magazine, and the Immunex-Cetus battle over that was an interesting story within biotech.
And say some more about that.
Well, you know, I never was privy, of course, to how decisions got made inside of Cetus. But they were involved in IL-2 when we began and began work on it. They got into it at a later time.
Did they?
Well, they may have had it on their list, but they weren't doing any research that anybody knew anything about. There had been no great publications coming out of Cetus on IL-2. Ultimately, the cloning of it was a goofy thing, too. It was done in Japan by a researcher who was being funded by a Japanese pharmaceutical company. And Henny and Gillis had given them some reagents, IL-2 reagents, before Immunex was created, which were for experimental purposes, but specifically it was prohibited that they would be used for cloning. He used them for cloning. Ultimately, they got the patent, but the patent ultimately got reassigned back to us. And then in the end, of course, IL-2 was a bust. And so it didn't matter so much who wound up winning the war. Cetus marketed it a bit, and Roche marketed it a bit. And it's still sold today, I'm told, but only for malignant melanoma and only as a kind of a last case therapy. But it was I will honestly say I thought Cetus was the hypiest organization in business that I had ever encountered in my life. We had a New Yorker cartoon that had appeared that showed some guys pouring some elusive material in one end of in a hopper at one end of a machine, and at the other end there was something coming out, and I don't remember what the two words were that were on the hopper and on the spout, but we changed them to hype and ultra hype.
Yeah.
And then the guys all had Cetus on the back of their lab coats in our version of the cartoon.
Yeah.
Because
were you involved with Ron Cape and in the IBA? Was he
Well, Ron was around, but it was already Bob Files was emerging as the guy.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And as far as I was concerned, when in my relationships with them, Cetus was really Bob Files because he was the public side of it at that point. Ron Cape was more of a distinguished scientist. Waved his hands over the whatever was going on there.
But he was the guy who did the trade association stuff.
He
right?
was involved with it along with Bob Swanson and George Rathman was very early involved in it. I can't claim that we were a year or so later than the others. It was an interesting, IBA was an interesting thing.
Before we talk about IBA, I just want to finish up with the origins of the company. And when nobody really had an idea of how much money it would take. When you put the plan together, did you have a notion of when?
No. We had some dates established when some things would happen, and those proved to be really wrong, because nobody that we had in our company, and I think this was pretty much true through the whole industry, really knew anything about the FDA and how much greater an amount of time it was going to take to get to the first human being with stuff, much less to get through the trials. Because everybody beyond the biotech world, which was very enthusiastic, everybody else was pretty skeptical and concerned. And so whatever dates we had in initial business plans and initial prospectuses kept getting shoved and shoved and shoved. But it was happening for the whole industry, so it wasn't absolutely killing the individual companies. There were already companies that were coming and going. Some of them didn't last very long, and most of them didn't last. A few of them were lucky enough to have something saleable when the shoe dropped, but of the original group of companies that I sort of lump everybody that got started in the first 4 or 5 years together, that initial group of companies kept getting smaller and smaller as time went by. And more and more attention got focused on the products of a handful of us. Really, that was the biotech story around the country. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I had not banked on, this is probably where my lack of experience with pharmaceutical companies was an issue. I did not understand that it would be so difficult to begin manufacturing this stuff. And to some extent, I can thank Chris and Steve for furthering my naivete, because they didn't understand it either. And they assured me right from the beginning that was nothing. That would be no problem at all. So, that was tough to do. Yeah. And it took a lot of money, and it took a lot of time to get to the point where you had drugs that you could give to people. Mm-hmm. We could give a lot of stuff to mice and monkeys, but we just couldn't give to people for the longest darn time. Mm-hmm. We found that our partners, in all cases, were not doing what they were supposed to do.
Really?
They were very slow to move. We would think we'd arrived at a certain place in the process, and they would absolutely insist that we weren't there yet, and that nobody was going to try this in a human being for 2 more years, and we were going to be running these experiments, and we were going to do this and do that. Everything was slow. The worst were the Germans, the Boehringer guys. I think that at the beginning of the CSF stuff, we had a big lead. We had GM CSF cloned way back. Early, but it just lingered and lingered and lingered while the Germans were supposed to do work on its scale-up and purification, and nothing happened. And right to the point where it ultimately got marketed, they fought us every step of the way. And it wasn't until I basically walked in and threatened to sue them for non-performance that we were given co-marketing rights and allowed to go ahead in the U.S. and do what we called the backyard moonshot. Did Gillis talk about the...
No.
And he was out of the business by then, but Gillis is a funny guy, and we suddenly saw a route through the FDA with GMCSF that would allow us just to seek a narrow approval for bone marrow, that we had some potentially approvable data. Mm-hmm. That had been analyzed by statisticians at the Hutch, and they thought it was approvable, that it was statistically significant. Mm-hmm. And so we decided to take this narrow little thing and try to get an early jump on the CSF market. And that was called the backyard moonshot. We didn't have a manufacturing plant at that point. We didn't have the could be licensed. Mm-hmm. And we wound up building it inside our lab.
And I guess you just need little bits of, or it's probably all you can produce.
Well, we had enough room in one part of our building. By then, we'd greatly expanded in terms of square footage. We had enough space to put in a couple of units and start making material. And so we did, and we ran some more clinicals as fast as we could run it. And we were beginning, and we went ahead and started to file our request for approval from the FDA quite quickly after I got the rights cleared up with Behringer, and we were allowed to go ahead.
Initially, the deal you had with them was that
they were going to market, and we were going to not market. There was a provision beyond that for any follow-on products that where we would become marketers. This was supposed to be staged in various steps.
Right. Who was paying for this?
They were paying for that, and they were paying for the research on GM-CSF, but we would be expected to step in and pay for, if we were going to co-market, to pay for development. So that the only way you could get any kind of co-marketing rights or was to be a co-developer. Mm-hmm. And so we knew that was coming.
And that's a big investment. Right?
Yes, it was a big investment. And it happened much more actually with products that we originally uncovered working with Kodak. I don't know if you knew that we did a deal with Kodak. Wanted to get into the pharmaceutical business, and they had decided that this giant inventory of chemicals they'd synthesized over the years might have therapeutic value. We had gobs of different assays that would allow us to look for chemicals that mimicked the activity of a particular cytokine or its receptor. And so we did a deal where we agreed to screen those chemicals and to look for drugs that way, and then they wanted to get into biotech, so we let them fund a series of later interleukins and their receptors, one of which was ultimately TNF and TNF receptor, and that became Enbrel. And they bought Sterling Drug. I don't know if that's part of what you've come across, but in the middle of this, they bought Sterling Drug, and then they hired a guy from Volkswagen to run it. Most amazingly inept company that I've ever been around. And it was almost like they calculated to see how dreadfully they could do some of this stuff. And finally, internally, all interest in pharmaceuticals died, and so I went in and negotiated the return of all of those things to Immunex for next to nothing. They'd invested a lot of money in it, but without us, it had nowhere to go. And so back came, among other things, Enbrel, although we didn't know it yet. And then I did a deal called Receptech. One of the favorite ways of funding biotech, although we had never used it, was the research and development partnership. And as a result of a tax code change, basically those were wiped out.
Right.
And so we created something that replaced it. It was an actual corporation, and we transferred certain molecules into the corporation. We set it up for us and did a separate IPO. But ultimately, we had the right to buy it back, either for stock or cash. And we did the research under contract from it. So it paid us to do do the research on the molecules. And it was a separate play on just that batch of products.
Right.
And so it worked very much like an R&D partnership. It didn't have a tax benefit, but it got around the punitive side of what they've done to try to eliminate some of the tax benefits of partnerships. And it actually worked very well.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, we bought it back for stock, and the people who bought Receptech stock and then held it made a lot of money. And then I suppose the final deal to touch on very quickly would be the one that was done at the end of my tenure with American Cyanamid. That's always misunderstood. It was understood, I think, fairly well when it was done by people. It was named the best deal in the industry for 1993 by Steve Burrell and at his Laguna Niguel meeting. Mm-hmm. What we did was acquire American Cyanamid's Letterly cancer product portfolio in return for giving stock in our company, which gave them a 51% ownership of Immunex, but with a governance agreement in place that effectively kept them from doing much of anything to run it. And until ultimately the thing that ruined that whole scheme was that the FinFin deal at American Home Products, who had by that time acquired American Cyanamid, became such a horrible liability that they had to raise cash. And that's what put Immunex in play, and that's why it became part of Amgen. But at that point, it was a very valuable company. And that merger between Amgen and Immunex was one of the top five or six in terms of value in the history of the pharmaceutical industry at the time it happened. I'm sure it's slipped way down now because of the values of things.
Sure.
But,
yeah.
So then at the end of getting that deal done, I announced on my own, as we started negotiating the deal, that if we do this and we're successful, then it's time for a pharmaceutical guy to run Immunex, and I'm out.
And that's because of the size?
Well, the size and the complexity and the fact that marketing was now the key thing we had to do. And I was not a pharmaceutical marketing guy. I knew nothing about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had started off this thing without knowing a lot about finance and this, you know.
But I realized there are limits to how far you can go without ever having done any of this stuff. And I just felt like we would never achieve anything on the marketing side, particularly. But manufacture all aspects of it until somebody skilled in the general management of pharmaceutical operations was involved there. Plus, I was exhausted. I had not only done that, but I'd done the IBA at the same time, and I was tired.
So, yeah.
And plus, I could see the years going by when I wouldn't be able to get my golf game where I wanted it. So
that was
I put it all together and decided I was going to take a few years off.
Did you take a few years off?
I did. I stayed on some boards, and most of them biotech related. In the main, I've been involved in nonprofit stuff since those days, and not. Not on any kind of paid basis. I've done my work and enjoyed it, but only as an outside guy who comes in and helps do that stuff. Mm-hmm. The IBA, just to give you that background, the IBA was a struggling organization from the beginning, and it always struggled. There was such internal contradiction and conflict in IBA that it's amazing that it made it at all. You first of all had these upstart pipsqueak companies versus big established pharmaceutical companies. Both of them are members, both of them on some basis believe that they have, or at least the pipsqueaks believe they have equal standing with the big guys. The big guys think we're all a bunch of idiots. We think the big guys are entirely capable of ruining the industry because they just don't understand what's happening. Then on a second level, there's a kind of almost a caste system within the biotech companies. And then you have the split between the ag side and the medical side. And even the medical side has more than one facet to it. It wasn't very long after the IBA came into being that a lawyer created something called the ABC, the American Biotechnology Congress or something. And so we had effectively two different voices, and it went after the smallest of the companies. It had scads of members. It had law firms and patent lawyers and all kinds of stuff that belonged to it that really weren't in the industry at all. But what was amazing was that it would very often, the two would take contradictory positions before Congress or all over the place, in states as well as at the federal level. It was we really had a trade association nightmare on our hands. We we had as good an executive as we could afford, and in fact, maybe he was better than than we deserved in the early days, and Dick Godown, a fine, fine man. But he also was in over his head in trying to build this thing, given all of this attachment. It was all hung up over Bovine somatotropin, which was kind of the poster child for conflict in the country over biotech. And I can't tell you how many biotech meetings, or IBA meetings, board meetings, were just consumed by dealing with that single product when all this other stuff existed out there that needed to be addressed, not the least of which was that this ABC was running around saying things like, well, you know, BST ought to be banned. You know, it was just horrible. So several attempts had been made to try to figure out some way to get this, and it wouldn't work. And I became chairman, I think, in 91. And it might have been 90. And Roger Salquist was the vice chairman. And I said, Roger, we've got to see if we can't solve some of this somehow. And I knew that when I came here today, I was never going to think of his name. There was a young man whose name I should remember and I don't, who was the head of the ABC at that time. He ran a biotech company. And he was a nice young guy. I had known him from Laguna Niguel because both kinds of companies came to that. And I liked him. Uh-huh. So I got him to agree to meet with me. And we held two or three meetings, and I kept proposing a structure that would allow these smaller companies who were worried about their voice to have a small business segment within, and yet we'd have a bigger overall thing. We'd create a board where they would have equal representation at the beginning. And let me tell you, Monsanto didn't think those companies ought to even be at the table with them. This was not universally liked as an idea, but it had to happen. We had to solve that problem. And over time, I persuaded him, and he went to work to persuade his side that that needed to happen. And one day in Washington, D.C., we sat down, and with a legal pad, I wrote out the agreement for the creation of BIO. And he and I signed it as a letter of intent, handwritten, no lawyers, nobody else there. I wish I'd kept that piece of paper. I don't know where it went. And I took it back to the IBA, and there was, of course, some things people wanted to change on our side, and the ABC began to talk about the things they wanted to change on their side, so I got together with my guy again. I said, let's just go back and say no changes. This is going to happen this way, and then the boards can sort it out. The board can sort it out over time. But let's just make this happen. And so we had a meeting of the IBA board, at which I announced that whoever uttered the words BST, or the initials at least BST, at any time during the meeting had to buy dinner and drinks for everybody at the end of the meeting, and that certain other subjects could not be discussed under any circumstances today, and we sat down and went through it, and at the end of the meeting, much to my amazement, they voted to accept it. Then we had to wait for the ABC, but they got it done, and in one fell swoop, we created BIO. I went and hired Carl Feldbaum, which I thought was a miracle that we got him, because I think he's...
Was he coming out of Arlen Specter's office at that time?
He was Arlen Specter's AA.
So how did you get him?
Through a headhunter. I got a headhunter to launch a search for us. And had gotten the board to... We assessed everybody for enough money to provide... we couldn't even tell Dick Godown what we were doing at that stage. We did have to provide for Dick Godown and his retirement and so on. All of those issues had to be resolved because he'd done a good job for us. It's just that there was a limitation to what he could do for us. And he had a very ill wife, and I didn't want him dumped at the end of this thing. I think that would have been a tragedy. There were people who wanted to just fire him, throw him out. And so, but Dick stayed on, I think, a year or two under Feldbaum as a kind of a deputy, and it worked out well. Carl came in as one of a handful of people to interview, and I knew the minute that he came in and I heard about his background and the family that he had come from, that Carl was our guy, that we had to get him. And we did. And then I left the board of IBA. or I mean, I, when IBA ceased to exist, we had to give up, under the new thing, there were a certain number of directors from each. We had to lose two or three people. I said, I'll be one of them. Mm-hmm. And so I went from chairman of IBA to not even involved in one swoop. I was, what's his name? Kirk Rob that ran Genentech became the first chairman of bio. He liked to say he was the first chairman of bio, but that's actually incorrect. I, for about an hour or two, was chairman of bio while we set it up and created it. Mm-hmm. And then Kirk took over as the chairman, and I, that was my last meeting.
Yeah. Who were you working with closely and getting all this done, or did you have to work, were the people working against you?
Well, there were plenty of people working against me. Several big company people and a couple of larger biotech firms really didn't want to do this. I should say that they acknowledged the problem existed and that something had to be done. I don't know whether they wanted to shoot everybody that belonged to the ABC or what they wanted to do. It had to be resolved, and we had to get rid of Godin. Those two things had to happen. But when it came down to a solution that would actually make those things happen, it was very hard to get them to embrace any idea. But Roger brought Monsanto and some others behind us, and I got the representative from Merck and a couple of others to agree to go back, and they came back and said they would do it. But I will tell you that this was, for a good part of it, a two-man deal where the ABC guy and I together would go back to our respective organizations and kind of lay it out on the table. And I wasn't trying to build coalitions as much as I was saying, here it is, do you want a solution to these problems, or don't you want a solution to these problems? And ultimately, I think everybody saw that while this may not be perfect, it would do the deal. And of course, it's become a fabulously successful thing, because once you got everybody in the same room and working on the same page, it did just what you thought it would do. Mm-hmm. It made such sense that it worked. And Carl, of course, was a big piece of that.
And now the 20,000 people show up from the convention.
Yep. Yeah. I've been a bit surprised that I've never ever received a thing from them. Not an invitation to a meeting. No. I've always wondered about that. I disappeared at the moment it was created, but I was, in some respects, the father of that deal because I set out to make it happen, and I never got a letter thanking me. Usually when you retire as chairman of something, they give you a cup or nothing of that ever happened. And, of course, it was because a new thing got created and the people who are supposed to look after that, but didn't realize that, I mean, they were new. They were trying to get into their situation. But I was surprised always over the years that nobody ever thought of that.
Well, maybe too late.
Oh, I don't. I suspect now. I'm not even Carl there anymore. So.
Well, you mentioned you were tired by the time you wanted to move on from Immunex. This is consuming doing this kind of work, and then what's at Immunex? What kind of demands were there on your time? Had your family?
Yes, although I, like about half the guys that were CEOs in biotech, I wound up divorced during all of this. Remarried reasonably quickly to a wonderful lady to whom I'm still married, and we've had a wonderful life. My daughters don't think they were deprived, but I was gone a lot. I traveled constantly, and being in Seattle, being on the West Coast, but particularly being in Seattle, made it more difficult. The Seattle sports teams moan and groan about how much travel they have to do, but let me tell you, the guys that are trying to be publicly traded and totally dependent for their existence on the stock market, a trip to New York was almost a weekly event, and there were many times when I would fly to New York, spend one day, and fly home that night.
Yeah, did your role change over time? Initially, you're an operations guy, right? Trying to put it together.
And it did change a lot.
Yeah.
I think I was at the end, what I was primarily was a negotiator and a guy who reviewed the work of the senior guys who were running the individual areas of the company. I certainly did strategic thinking for the company. I mean, the buyback of the Kodak stuff and the Baron-Verka joint marketing deal and those things, not only did I go and negotiate those, but I really created those ideas. Those were mine. Increasingly, the CFO or the COO or the chief science officer were running their areas, and they were trained and how we wanted to do it, and they were very good at what they did. You can take this. I'm okay. Holding you guys up.
No, you're fine. I just want to make sure you're okay.
Well, I'm not obviously going to get it eaten.
You want to box it up?
No. I've got to go on to another affair.
Okay. You want some more water or diet or anything?
I'm fine. Thank you. My role had changed a lot. I'd gone from being a very hands-on, day-to-day operator of a small little business to a guy who was running a business as a CEO should run a business, not running anything much on an individual day-to-day basis, but running everything through other people. I'll get this. No. You've come a long way today.
Okay.
Delegation was a good thing. I have to, going back to my days as a young trainee in a manufacturing business in Seattle, that engineer that I mentioned, I've always said was the guy I learned as much from about running the business as any other man, and I mostly learned it from him by negative example. I would have to say that, and I would... I would never want his name used in
sure.
any of this,
sure.
but, because he was a fine man, but he was not a fine CEO. And among the things that he never did that created the great problem at the end was to have a succession plan or have a way to get him out and somebody else in to run the business. And so I swore, as Immunex progressed, that the day was going to come when I would know how to extract myself completely from the business and turn it over to other people to run and make sure that happened in a nice, fluid, easy way. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't going to be one of these guys who won't get out of the room. And it was one of the negative examples that really impacted me. And in part, too, because I had stayed on that board all those years as an outside director and watched it from that viewpoint for a long time. It was not attractive, and so I made up a plan that if I could get Immunex to the point where I was sure that there was funding for the next stage of product development, the Enbrels and other stuff, that would be the right time to have a CEO guy come in. And we were lucky enough to get Fritzky, who I think did a marvelous job. And I was a consultant to the company for 3 years, but I was out otherwise. Mm-hmm. And it worked perfectly. Mm-hmm. We did not have a single glitch from that standpoint.
Yeah. How were things along the way with Chris Henney and Steve Gillis?
Well, I adore Steve Gillis. And he and I had minds that were sufficiently alike in a number of ways that we really got along well. We traveled well together. We rarely had disagreements. When we did, we could resolve them without screaming and shouting. Chris Henney and I did not get along very well. I have to tell you that I admire his mind as much as any mind I've ever come in contact with. Chris Henney is an absolutely brilliant guy. And there's not a doubt in my mind that had he not been present at the birth of Immunex, that things would have worked out as well as they did. He had to be there because he really did. He had this kind of worldly vision of the research we were going to get engaged in. And we needed that in addition to all these nuts and bolts and other stuff I was concerned with. We needed this kind of brilliant oversight that he provided. He then chafed a great deal in all of this because he wasn't accustomed to business organizations. He wasn't accustomed to going out into the big wide world with the CEO and discovering that people wanted to talk to the CEO, not him. And that they thought the CEO was the company, not him. Those were great problems for Chris. And so there is just no doubt in my mind that his kind of brain power is really important to things like an Immunex. It's just too bad that he, you know, he just wasn't capable of immersing himself in the organization too, because who knows what he might have done if he could do both of those things. Steve was running the science almost from day one.
Yeah. Were there any problems at any point with different strategic visions for where the company should go?
Yeah, I think occasionally. Yeah. But those were rarely the problem. The real problem was just the clash of cultures that we came from. Mm-hmm. And Chris was not, I mean, he wasn't raised in the U.S. He certainly wasn't raised around cattle ranch kids who are just sort of pragmatists and want to get something done today and the organization means everything to us because we see how that makes it happen. That wasn't Chris's thinking at all. He came from a totally different world. And so I think that clash was inevitable. But I will hand it to him. He was important to us. And he was important, I think, to the subsequent organizations he was in, although I think ultimately exactly the same circumstances emerged at other places. Mm-hmm. Well, I know they did it. Yeah. One of them.
Well, Immunex, I guess the culture took on a life of its own, and yes, people remember it. And have you been back and involved in
lots
of that? Yeah,
I have. And I'm at least a financial contributor to this ongoing. People were taken with our philanthropy as a company, and they've continued it. The employees have a foundation that is doing a tremendous amount in the Seattle area.
Is it medical stuff? Or
no, it's far
things?
More a sustainability of our society.
Oh, okay.
And a little of it's woo-woo-woo, maybe, but I think it's been a wonderful way for a lot of them to hang together. Yeah, Steve might have told you a lot about the Immunoids.
No, thank you.
Right. Thank you.
They, Immunex was a great place to be. I do not know how anyone could have possibly been through that process for a few years and not have been touched I mean, it altered your DNA a little bit.
So it was different for you than the other companies that you had.
Oh,
you know, I mean, been deeply involved in those too, right?
Yeah, so. Right. But there was I never had any experience like this in anything that I've been involved in. I mean, people genuinely believed that they were on an important mission, that the company was very valuable to society and was doing good things. And people felt good about the work they were doing. At the same time, I've alluded to the fact that we felt a little bit like the Rodney Dangerfields of big-time biotech, because we were up in Seattle and nobody took us particularly seriously for a long, long time. And every time there was a competition between us and somebody else, it was just sort of assumed by the rest of the world that the somebody else was going to win the competition. Yet I thought the science we were doing, by several measures, was the best science being done by anybody. I think there are a lot of people from other companies who would say Immunex's science was as good as anything that was out there at that time. So this us against them created a kind of cohesiveness, and we've actually used that to our advantage with this Immunoid business, the Immunoids against the world, and we did a lot of things to try to foster it. We had Friday night happy hours, which were not unique to us, but I think the Immunex happy hours as they unfolded were unique to anywhere, particularly the one on Halloween. That was, people came dressed, spent the whole day in costume, and the costumes became ever more elaborate, and the Halloween party was happening. It was unbelievable.
And how about operating in the city? You're always in Seattle.
Right downtown.
Was Seattle good? They were
well,
business friendly, science friendly?
I had a lot of fights with Seattle. And there were plenty of times when I threatened to move to Bothell. We had land out there. We had a plant out there. Maybe more than anybody else, I was absolutely convinced that an urban environment would allow us to recruit better people. That scientists of the kind we were after, we were not after established Nobel contenders. We were after the youngest, brightest guys we could find in the world in the fields that we were interested in.
And did that come from Steve Gillis and Chris Henney? Was that their notion of how to do it, to get maybe
yes.
the best postdoc, so to speak?
Yeah, guys right out of post. Yes, we from the opening bell, they said that's the guys we should target, the brightest minds that we know we can find in the different disciplines that we're interested in, and we should bring them in right away, right out of their postdoc program. And I became convinced, as the more of them that I met, that having them right in the middle of downtown was going to be the place that would be attractive to them. And we were right by the Pike Place Market. We were there are 50 funky beer taverns within 4 miles, 3 miles in any direction except toward the water. And so it really, I think it helped foster that culture, no question about it. And then Gillis created the team approach to research that we used, which I did not know of another place using. We didn't have Sam's lab and Joe's lab, and they did their everything in their lab that they wanted to do. We had the IL-2 project, and people were assigned to it, and there was a team leader, and you were part of that team, and it was interdisciplinary. You did not have a project that was your sole thing to work on. You might be the only guy working on a particular project at any point in time, because that's where the work needed to get done, but it wasn't your project. And so that team approach, I think, paid enormous dividends. We designed our facilities to try to facilitate that. We created little niches where people passing might just go over and sit down, and we put whiteboards there so they could write on it.
And that worked? People
it did.
Used those spaces the way?
You bet it did. We had them on the landings of stairs. I'd always seen people stop on the landings of stairs and talk. So we put whiteboards along the landings of the stairs. And people stopped and talked, and then pretty soon it was natural to us scientists to go over and pick up that pen and start scribbling on the board. That team approach was, you cannot underestimate how important that was to us. And I believe it was reasonably unique to us.
Well, one other thing I want to ask about is to be in this business at that time, well, still, it's almost inevitably entails intellectual property disputes. And I got a call from a guy in Boston who was involved with Alex Rich, MIT, and I haven't talked to them yet, but there was something there with IL-2. Was there a case?
There is a case in IL-2 because there was a... I don't know whether this was ever a lawsuit, but there was a long-standing dispute over the patent to IL-2 because of the use of materials and technology that had been given to the Japanese for one purpose, and then it was used for a different one, and the clone resulted from that. And then, of course, there was also a patent between Cetus, there's a dispute between Cetus and the rest of us, the rest of us being the Japanese, Immunex, and Roche.
No, it comes to me, it was IL-1, actually, that these guys were working on.
One I just don't remember, but it's...
Yeah.
There was a suit. It's funny how... You know, this is 30 years ago, and I'm 72, and let me tell you, your memory begins to lose it. But there was a case where a guy claimed that we had used something of his. I don't remember what it was, or we had seen a paper of his. I can't remember the exact details. But yes, I remember being deposed for that case, even though I knew virtually nothing about it.
And what about, was Amgen? It seemed like Amgen was always
You know, but I don't think we ever had a dispute with them because their CSF molecule was a different molecule.
Oh, than ours. You were doing GM,
and they were doing G. And aside from that, we didn't really have any product fights per se. There were other instances that I can remember where we were very unsure of ourselves with respect to our right to a patent in some areas because we knew other stuff had been going on. But those tended to resolve themselves. We didn't have hardly any lawsuits, period. We used to get sued for shareholder lawsuits all the time because our stock would go plunging. There was one guy in Seattle who just loved to go, being a lawyer, he loved to go fishing in our files to try to find something that he could.
And that's a bit an aggravation for you, and more than Steve Gillis or anything. That's all on you.
And what a system where, they really haven't any idea. I once got this guy sued everybody, and I got a summons and complaint. Our stock had fallen, and we were accused of having withheld the information that the investors would have needed to avoid this. And the summons and complaint had on several pages Nordstrom's name instead of Immunex's. And completely scrubbed it. So they were alleging the same facts exactly in this two different cases. But we were lucky in Seattle. I say lucky in a negative way. We had a federal judge who used to let most of this stuff go to trial, or at least it was headed for trial, because he was an ex-defendant, a plaintiff's lawyer who had done similar kinds of stuff. And he was just terrible. This stuff he'd always say, yeah, no, you can take that issue to trial. Mm-hmm. And so we'd settle. And we did it three times.
Yeah.
But other than that, we didn't have too many. We did sue Behring Verka.
You did, actually.
Yeah, we sued them.
After you got the...
After the drug got approved. For their failure to do their...
They weren't marketing it?
They were not marketing it on their side. We were marketing, they were not marketing, but they were screwing up our marketing.
Yeah.
We were having a real problem with them. Very, very funny organization in the U.S. I was impressed with Buxt in Germany. I thought that was a quality operation. But their New Jersey thing, they used to sell these dumpy drugs, and it was not the first team in there selling anything. And that was all they had, really, in the U.S., was a sales operation. They didn't have anything else. And these guys got GM CSF. They'd never had anything even remotely like it. Couldn't even imagine that it would be useful. And so they spent most of their time trying to screw it up. I think maybe hoping it would go away, because it was clear they didn't have the wherewithal to market it. So we did wind up suing them, and we didn't have otherwise very many suits, and they really weren't over patents other than the IL-2 dispute, and then which was resolved essentially in our favor. Cetus lost that deal. And then the that one issue you brought up, but I don't, I couldn't even tell you who the individuals were.
I think Alex Rich was the big guy at MIT, I think, but I haven't talked to them yet.
You should. I don't remember the details. Obviously, there were disagreements all over the place in that business at that time. That was the Wild West.
Yeah, yeah.
It was. It was, industries at their birth are full of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so it's right place, right time, do you feel like, for yourself?
Yes, I've always thought that I was very fortunate to have simply stumbled into the biotech business in the way that I did. And I've been very pleased that I was able to respond in a way that we were one of the success stories that came out of it. And our shareholders, all except those that had no faith, all made a lot of money. Mm-hmm. If you bought Immunex on the offering in 1983, your return was enormous. Mm-hmm. And our employees did extremely well. The earliest employees of that company all became well-to-do people.
Yeah.
We educated gobs of kids whose parents worked at Immunex.
Mm-hmm. That has to make you feel very good, right?
Yeah.
Seattle hasn't quite taken off the way other places have. I mean, there's stuff going on there, but...
Yeah. No, I agree with that. And And I truly believe it's the remoteness of it compared to where the centers are elsewhere. I think that Seattle has the critical mass to be the equal of Silicon Valley in the electronics software field, but it doesn't have the critical mass to be the equal of the Bay Area or Boston in biotech. Unfortunately, there's a tremendous amount of great university research being done there, but it has not led to entrepreneurship.
Well, listen, after going through this again, did anybody else come to mind as somebody I should contact and talk to? I've got the names you mentioned earlier.
Well, let me give it another quick thought. Tom Cable was a good one.
Yeah. Good. Thanks.
Dick Kramlich would be a good one to talk to.
Yeah.
You probably have talked to Dick, or you're going
to. I haven't talked to Dick. I talked to Chuck Newell and Jim Barrett in NEA. But yeah, I should.
They got into NEA, I think, after NEA got into Immunex, and Kramlich was our guy. And then Frank
Bonzel?
Bonzel, that's it. Thank you. Frank back east was also involved with us. And we were involved with the Rothschilds in London and in New York.
Oh, was Jim Blair?
Jim Blair was involved in getting London fund to invest in Immunex. David Leathers was the guy at the time. And then he gave way to Jeremy Curnock Cook, who came in and ran that fund. They later created a second one, and I was on the board of that for a number of years. I was by that time out of Immunex, and I was on the board of the second biotech fund that they created over there, along with Jim Grant, who ran, what was the name of his company? Never did very well, and he was a former deputy U.S. public health director. Surgeon General, Deputy Surgeon General, and a couple other investment guys from the U.S. Jim Blair was always very involved in those funds.
I'm trying to get a hold of people at Zymogenetics very early. I know the two scientists, but do you happen to recall who are the business people that sort of helped them put that together? Because I'm pretty sure it wasn't these two scientists.
No, but, you know, they didn't really have very good...
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it really wasn't much of a company for a long time.
Yeah.
And then
Bruce Carter
came in. And that's kind of when it went from being not much to being something.
Yeah.
And weren't they by that time held to some considerable extent by another company?
Novo, right?
Right, Novo, that was it. And didn't he come out of Novo, maybe?
I don't remember.
Yeah, they had put that deal together to do research or transfer technology or something, and I think somehow that's how he emerged there. But that took forever to get going. Zymo was a very late bloomer, although born at precisely the same time as Immunex. It didn't do any of those other things for a long time.
And did you know the genetic systems guy? I understand Nowinski. I haven't met it, but I understand it. The Blacks and Nowinski.
Well, it was just exactly what you'd expect out of the Blex and Nowinski.
Okay.
I don't know Nowinski very well. I met him a half a dozen times. I never thought of them as a serious company. I thought of them as a serious promotion. And as it turned out, they weren't a serious company. They sold out for a farthing compared to what their market cap had gotten to be. Everybody assumed Immunex was the number two company in Seattle for the first 2.5 or 3 years because they were just going gangbusters, if you believe all the stuff coming out there. But Henny and Gillis were absolutely convinced that monoclonal antibodies were not going to be the basis of a business at that point.
They worked for a while.
It took
a long time.
And that was the basis of their business. And they could take a contract to sell somebody a monoclonal antibody for diagnostic purposes, which you knew was not worth a hoop in hell, and make it sound like they just cloned people. It was unbelievable. But the blacks, I thought, you know, too bad that an industry has to have the blacks. But every industry, I think, gets some people.
Yes. Actually, I think the biotech business done pretty well in terms of not having
very many of that stuff. I agree. I completely agree.
Pretty good record.
We had the deal in New York with Martha Stewart.
Right, but that's, you know, you have to reach pretty far before you get to those.
No, you do. And a lot of very, very strong, good companies with good people emerge out of all of that. And some that, you know, the other thing that people can never get away from is that there is a huge amount of luck involved in the ones that won and the ones that lost. Mm-hmm. We were lucky. Some other very good companies weren't lucky.
Yes.
I think Chiron comes to mind first of all as in that way. They didn't quite have the same amount of luck in terms of having things that just fit together right so they could just keep steadily going ahead. And what is it? Hybritech, wasn't that the big monoclonal company?
San Diego.
Same. Right. I think they had quality stuff. They just, you know, it took them forever to get a product and because the science wasn't there yet.
Right. They had to humanize the antibodies before they could make it.
They're part of Zymo Genetics? Was it Zymo? I think so. It was a couple of Scandinavian people. They were from Sweden. Man and wife. And they were doing monoclonal antibodies. And somehow I think they wound up in Zymo. And there was... Penny and Gillis used to call it Scandibodies. There was a lot of gallows humor.
Yes.
I think throughout the industry, though. I mean, I'd go to those. Bob Swanson and I and Roger and two or three others used to occasionally have meetings that didn't involve anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about dealing with the big companies and trying to make IBA work. And this was before I became the chairman by a number of years. And that we were all kind of the same sort of people. I mean, we were, you know, when you're hanging out as far as we were hanging out in some ways, there's plenty of room for gallows humor in that kind of
set. Yeah. So Bob Swanson was, I never had an opportunity to meet him.
I thought Bob Swanson was a great guy. He was a guy who I think better than many other people recognized what he did well and what he didn't do well, and he set Genentech up so that it could get maximum benefit from him, but he didn't let his ego get terribly involved in how that worked out, and I admire him a lot. I thought it was a great loss when he went, and I always thought it was too bad that I didn't think they necessarily always had the best CEO and for the situation that they had, and had he been able to be more involved for a longer period of time, I think would have been very useful for them. I liked him. I liked George Rathman. George was not a guy you got to know and pal around with. George, there's not a whole lot of fun in George. He was a very serious guy. And I don't mean by that he was grouchy or difficult, but he was not he was older, first of all, than the rest of us. I was 40. Swanson was slightly younger than me, I think. And Roger and I are the same age. There were a lot of guys about that age. But George was almost a generation older.
Roger was he had fun doing what
Roger Salkus would find fun at Auschwitz. He is just that kind of guy. He is up a lot. I don't know how he does it some days. Because things can be not so sunny. And he's just has a great time. He has a great wife. Nice guy. For everything except golf. Not a great golfer.
He's not a great golfer. Are you a great golfer? Good?
I can play.
And
I've devoted a lot of my time since I retired to trying to see how good I can play. I'm a fairly low single-digit handicap player.
Yeah, okay, good. And so that's the big draw to Arizona, I suppose?
Well, yes. But my wife likes this is a place to work on her sculptures. She thinks that she does better work when it's not cloudy, when the sun's out. The creative juices run better in a sunny climate. And plus that, she is a her hobby is to ride dressage. And that's the here or Southern California are two great places to do that. So she does it here, and I wouldn't. I told her there was only one place we couldn't live, and that was in California.
Not California.
I could kind of see some of the financial issues coming
quite a long time ago.
Yeah. And I just didn't want to be a resident of California. We decided we were going to be residents of Arizona or wherever, Hawaii, wherever we went, the sunshine, because we'd be here 8 months of the year. And we were going to limit the Great Northwest to 4 months. And that's what we've done. We go up there and...
But it's a real change of pace.
Yeah, everything about it's different. And, but I like it here. I've enjoyed the things that you can get involved with in the community here. This is a community growing up much younger than Seattle, and I like that. Because I've helped to create two or three entities and get them helped set up. I'm not doing anything to run them, but they fill nice niches here, important niches, and for the most part in North Scottsdale, that area up there, none of that existed.
Well, Steve, is there anything else we should know or anything else you'd like to say on the record?
No, that's plenty. I was amazed when I went back to just in the drive coming down here today, I was thinking about things that maybe ought to be brought up, and I was amazed that at this distance of time, how details have slipped. I mean, the big flow of events is still very clear to me, but the details, the little... things that happened, and like that IL-1 thing, I hadn't thought of that for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's our problem. It's the historian's problem. Because if we don't know. The guy happened to call me and tell me about IL-1. Come, and otherwise I wouldn't. No, and I'm sure there are a thousand things like that, that would be good to know that we just don't know about. So.
To a very real extent, that never turned into anything because IL-1 didn't turn into anything.
Right,
You can have a big fight, but have a big fight over something that has no value or appreciable value. Only academic people can do that.
Right. But just the fact that there are details. How many stories that are important to the history of biotech that were...
Will this be a big book?
I think it's going to be. It needs to be big because you've got a lot of great stories.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we're organizing the book is we're going to follow... This will be the volume one, by the way. But we're going to... the 15 or 20... major companies between, started from Cetus, Genentech through, Genzyme, 83, 84, 85, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Follow them through. I'm not sure exactly where we'll stop this at some turning point. Maybe it's when Amgen gets their blockbuster drugs and that changes the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's a little bit later when mid-90s, I think there were a lot of FDA approvals were going on just at the time when financing was getting difficult. So, but in any case, we're going to tell the story of these companies.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot there.
Oh yeah. Another guy that was involved, just made me think of him as you were talking there. David Hale was another guy who
we talked to David. Yeah.
David was a very valuable guy for the industry. I appreciated him a good deal.
He was involved with the IBA?
Yeah, and he used to get involved at Laguna Niguel. And he, more than once, when Swanson and I and these other guys would get together, he would be along with us.
When he was at Gensia or Hybertech, Gensia?
I don't remember him from Hybertech, so it must have been Gensia.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he was at Hybertech.
Yeah, I know now that you said that he was, but I don't remember him being out in the public side of what we all did?
Well, I think Ted Green was the CEO there, and David was the president for a long time, and then went to Gensia and became CEO. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I remember most from is then.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he was very active in San Diego, too.
He was.
Active in Los
Angeles. One time we had our meeting there next door to Torrey Pines at Laguna, I remember him specifically from that meeting. We used to just fly in and sit around a hotel room for a day, and then we'd fly back out.
Uh-huh.
it was always worthwhile because we and the guy who was really the impetus for getting it going was Fonz.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you
great.
Very much. Ooh, I'm right on time.
Good.
I'm almost.